This is BSA by Design, a podcast about transforming healthcare educational and research facilities through expert design and insight. I'm your host, Brian Moore. In this episode, we're going to talk about market design trends in healthcare and higher education with two of our interior design team members. My guests in this episode are Karen Tobin and Jennifer Hoskins. Karen Tobin is an interior design lead with BSA's Raleigh Studio, a graduate of the University of Missouri-Columbia with a degree in interior design, architectural studies. Karen has WELL AP and NCIDQ certifications. Jennifer Hoskins is a senior interior design and interiors lead at BSA's Austin Studio, a graduate of Texas State University with a Bachelor of Interior Design and a graduate of the University of Texas at Austin with a Bachelor's in Government. Jen is IIDA and LEED AP certified. Prior to joining BSA, she worked for Smith Group and Perkins & Will. Welcome to the show, Jennifer, Karen. Thanks for joining me.
Glad to be here.
Great to be here.
Great. Well, you're both first-time guests on the podcast. You know, it's kind of tradition on BSA by Design. Let's talk about how you both got into interior design, where your passion comes from. Karen, why don't you start us off?
So I've always been interested in the arts and design. And my dad is actually a furniture dealer. So I grew up being able to shadow him and interning for him. And so I kind of grew up in that world. And then when I joined the major at Mizzou, it was just a natural fit. I felt like this is where I'm supposed to be.
Jen, how about you?
I took a little bit of a longer road. I did always enjoy creative. I loved art classes as a kid, but kind of went government law route and was working at a law firm and had a colleague that was an interior design major working as a file clerk there. And she would show projects and I'd be like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize there was a sector of like commercial design. So took a stab at it on a summer course. It was a lot like law, honestly, collecting lots of data, synthesizing it, creating a narrative for a client. So it kind of came naturally and it was a lot more fun than writing legal briefs and memos. So why not?
I'm glad you bridged those together of how they were similar, because on the surface, it feels like, whoa, law and interior design, two totally different things, right?
You have to be extremely creative in law as well. So just in a different part of the brain, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was a natural fit.
Let's dive into our topic. I wanted to have you guys on to talk about market design trends, but my first question is, what are the biggest interior design trends you're seeing in healthcare facilities right now?
I think we're seeing a lot more elevated hospitality. We've thrown hospitality, the word around for a long time now, and kind of sticking in that sort of 3 to 4 star hotel to give the amenities in the lobby. And kind of that's where it ended. Now we're seeing we want 5 star. We want a response to our customers immediately, intuitively. We want the 5 senses. We want branding identified literally and then sort of subjectively in the space.
Right.
I think following restaurants, hotels that have been doing that for a while, which challenges us because we're wondering how do we hit all those 5 senses? And now they've identified extra senses. So more data coming down. And then, of course, the technology is just such a big trend in how we're keeping up with it.
I would just add, it's not so much of a trend. It's just something that we're always doing in our healthcare projects, but it's incorporating biophilic design and nature. Now humans have this innate desire to be connected to nature, and we spend 90%+ of our time inside. So there's evidence that shows that patients can actually heal faster when connected to nature. So we're always incorporating wood tones and textures and colors that are found in nature. Anything we can do to tie back to the interior space to the outside to help that space feel a little bit more calming and comfortable.
Right. And this is for my own knowledge. When you say texture, what do you mean by texture? Like touching and feeling things that are more found in nature?
Yes. Texture and visual texture as well. We always have to be careful with healthcare and infection control. So texture can be kind of a sensitive aspect that we need to make sure that it's easy to clean, that it's that we're using upholsteries and things that are vinyl, but they might look more like fabric, a little bit more natural and soft.
How is the focus on patient experience-driven design decisions?
It's a driving factor on all of our projects. So, in the beginning of a project, we do an alignment session with the owner and we figure out what are the goals for the project. And beyond making sure that it's going to fit within the budget or their cost, patient experience is always top. They really want to make sure that how we're designing this is really keeping the patient journey through the forefront. So, as we're going through design, we are thinking through that experience of the patient from the moment they enter, from a exterior parking standpoint to coming into the lobby, and to their final destination. What is their experience? What is their caregiver, their family, whoever's coming with them? What are they feeling during that space? I think that's something that us as interior designers bring to the project, that maybe some of the other teammates, don't necessarily think through those details, but, it's definitely at the forefront of everything.
Yeah, because I can see this blend between, I've had many of our colleagues on in the past talking about, the journey mapping and the site planning in terms of how they get from here to there. But within that, it's like you said, what feelings are they having? What emotions are they going through? And I'm sure colors, furniture, all those things are playing into this reaction as they're walking through or engaging in a space or they're sitting down. So that's really interesting.
I think that what's great when our health systems really get involved in it, we do, as Kara mentioned, the alignment sessions. And then sometimes we have a couple of them that will go that extra step where they'll let their consumer experience or their patient experience teams participate in our mock-ups, our physical mock-ups, VR, and we can get that sort of real-time data while they're walking through. They can bring a visit or a family member that also gives that perspective. And I've seen it done where we've collected through sticky notes and we're posting, or it's just dialogue, or we give them a QR code, and they leave and they can reflect a little bit and go, what? I just realized XYZ, and I want to share that too. When the healthcare systems go that extra step, it's really insightful.
I would imagine too, if you've got that patient experience team, if they're engaged throughout the process, it's probably making for a better end product, I would imagine.
So as Karen mentioned, we're doing it at alignment. And then if they allow us to do that extra step during the mock-up phase, we get that full complete. And then later we can do the surveys after the built environment is there and see how we've done. So it's a full circle of information and feedback that we can use later.
Let's shift for a second. Let's talk about higher education for a moment. Karen, what trends are you seeing in student centers and academic buildings?
So a few things come to mind. One is designing for student wellness and belonging. That's something that's really important to students. So creating meditation spaces, inclusive restrooms, again, bringing in those biophilic elements, making it feel welcoming and comfortable for any kind of student that is touring the space and going to these universities. Kind of related to that and that inclusive design, we're seeing a trend towards designing for neurodiverse individuals and really thinking about how do we design the space for everybody. They say 15 to 20% of people is neurodiverse, and I feel like this is a population we haven't designed for in the past. And so we're seeing more research come out about it, and more design opportunities to really design for everybody. And a third trend that I can think of is kind of an unfortunate one, but it's designing for student safety. That's become a driver on a lot of our projects, and just that active shooter situation and really designing the building around that situation potentially happening, just to make sure that we're protecting the safety of students and staff.
I'll put in a plug here. We had Emmy Tyson on just a few episodes ago on a whole conversation about designing for neurodiversity. And it's always fascinating to me. How's the shift towards hybrid learning along those lines affected physical space design?
Say designing for flexible tech-enabled classrooms is something that we're seeing. I wouldn't say that it's a huge change that we've seen post-COVID from pre-COVID, but just having that flexibility for future technology, having the infrastructure there, having the power there to be able to incorporate that and creating informal learning spaces, both within the classrooms and then collaboration spaces outside the classroom so that students can work on their laptops, maybe with other people remotely. I've heard it termed, they want more of a co-working type space than traditional learning style classrooms. So that's kind of the shift that we're seeing in the higher ed world.
Yeah, I'll make a comment here too. The leadership team and BSA's board were just in Raleigh a few weeks ago and got to tour the Wake Tech Education Innovation Center. And I was just blown away. We can't get away from our own experiences, right? Of what like college was like for us. And we were in a room all day doing our meetings. And of course, we toured the building. And to your point, I was blown away by the massive amounts of daylight and the windows. And thinking back to these brick cinder rooms that were just closed off from anything outside in the rooms that I used to go to. And then just like you said, some of these spaces, like when the board was meeting separately from the leadership team, we kind of went outside the room and I could find a space near the windows that was very comfortable furniture and it had some greenery around me. And it was just a very pleasant working environment. So I'll make a plug for that. I'll put a note or a link in the show notes to the Wake Tech Education Innovation Center is a great example of that conversation.
Just one thing to add on that particular project, within the student commons, we actually created a little zone for the students to have a gaming corner, which was nothing I had when I was going to school, but having that opportunity to connect to technology and giving the students that that fun little corner to be able to do that is something that we're seeing more of.
That's very cool. How are changing student expectations influencing campus interior design as a whole?
So as I mentioned, equity and inclusion is really important for students. So that's something that we see that they're looking for. Amenity-rich options, whether it's the gym, lounges, cafes, things like that. A focus on wellness is really important. I think that students are starting to expect that. And related to that, sustainability. They're wanting to know more about the buildings that we're designing, what's going into them. I think the carbon emissions, being able to have that information and share it as students are learning more about this and what the buildings, how they can be more sustainable. That's definitely something that's important.
Jumping back to healthcare, how do you balance functionality with creating spaces that feel welcoming in?
I think the old adage of everything has a home that we use in our own lives, personal, office desks, where we work, and even in healthcare design and all design in general, is knowing what we need, what the tools that we're going to be seeing, what equipment, how the flows work. We try early on in our design development meetings to understand all of them. I mean, we love a list. We love walking through. We have two clinicians on staff that I know that have been on the podcast before that help us with that too. Because if we know them, we can find places for them. We can conceal them, not hide, but conceal from the patient's point of view, whether it's from a lobby point of view, in an inpatient bed, if there's trash, hampers, wall-mounted devices, we can have them turn a corner, conceal them behind a wood look panel, PPE, hide that behind a warm tone that doesn't have hardware on it. Maybe it's concealed as well. All of that clutter, I think, escalates anxiety. Karen mentioned the neurodiversity. We know that. We know that from our own selves, wherever we are on the spectrum.
It really does for me. Yeah.
Yes. So I think that's like the first one, and that's an easy one. It's just getting the information and having tools to organize that information in-house while we're designing, and that promote the staff. I think it probably gives trust to the patients. They feel safer. And then I think the other one that is my trigger is lighting in these facilities. We have to have it.
Right.
We have light levels that we have to achieve for certain tasks or procedures, but we know about eye fatigue now. We know that we don't need certain light levels for just passive observation or interactions. And I think we're seeing a lot of design now really thinking about the integrated lighting, indirect lighting. We want to feel and sense the light, but we don't want to see where it's coming from, right?
Right.
And I think something that I would want to explore earlier on in our projects too, as Karen mentioned, and y'all talked about daylighting, is the layering of the daylighting and the artificial light. And how are we doing it? And are we doing it in a way that complements both? Or are we doing it in a way that's, if we're overlighting artificially and that we're not letting our daylighting do its job? And then, of course, we have all this circadian lighting that we can do.
Oh,
and
yeah.
If a facility wants to go that direction, have that automated, that's amazing. But that's probably the biggest one, is I feel like when we walk into some of these older facilities, the lighting just stands out, whether it's too bright, too white, so color temperature wise, or the glare of the bulb, we can see it. And then it kind of gives you that spot in your eye when you look away, all those things. And I think, again, that
you're
just
staring
triggers
at the spotlight or the sun.
And again, that just triggers anxiety. It feels sterile. So just giving the patients and the staff the autonomy to change the light levels, to have that choice. Those are some things, too, that just kind of pull that. We have to have the function. We know we have to have the function, but how do we make it seem like it's seamlessly integrated, it's beautiful, and it's still calming?
Follow-up question on the circadian rhythm. Have you had projects that have wanted to go that route?
I've had one. It was at a previous firm, and it was automated, part of their system. They also could control it from the bed, the pillow speaker. If they didn't want to use it, the patient could. And then we also did I think there was maybe 4 tiers of lighting besides the 3 that we already provide, which is like reading, exam, and ambient.
Yeah.
They had lighting at the foot wall and the head wall. We didn't do RGB on that one, but they did do a warmer tone. And then we did the circadian element as another layer. Let's hope it gets in. But some of these facilities are so large and so big. And so what is the technology that's going to come out between,
between
today of designing and then
2030?
So we'll see what happens.
Okay. I'd like to talk a little bit about evidence-based design. We've talked about it on this podcast before. I know internally and externally, we talk about it a lot. I think for our audience, though, I like to put it into, what does it mean in practice for you and your projects when we talk about evidence-based design?
As part of our innovation framework, before we're putting any pencils to paper, we are exploring and aligning. We talked a little bit about that aligning session earlier, but this is when we are doing our research. We're doing walkthroughs of the existing space if it's a renovation or an addition. So we're doing FPOEs, the functional post-occupancy evaluations. We're gathering information. We're working with our researchers. We're working with our nurses that we have on staff to figure out what's working, what's not working within their space. What are evidence-based practices that we've seen happen at other facilities like this that we could implement in this facility? And you know, there's a lot of that front-end work that we're doing before we get into design, so that we're creating a tailored solution for them that is incorporating the latest and greatest research and data that we have on that type of project.
How long does that process generally take? I mean, I'm sure it varies from project to project, but just in an overarching sense, is that 2 months, 6 months, 3 months?
Yeah, I mean, it totally depends on the size of the project, I'd say. And I don't think there's an end date on it either, because we continue to do research as we're getting into the design, and you know, we're getting into a more granular level of selecting finishes. Well, there's evidence on different flooring types that we need to be incorporating into our space. So there's not really an end. So it's a little bit hard to put an exact number on how long that takes.
We have research here at BSA, which is amazing. We get to use them. They're just a chat away to meeting with our director of research, who makes herself available often for our projects. And there's some stuff that has become sort of natural vocabulary design, like the biophilia and the daylight,
right,
that we know of those evidence-based design traits from yesteryear. But they're constantly getting new research, and we have training sessions here in BSA, but we also can go to her with our specific projects when we have a head scratcher, and we get real-time data that's just come out. Or you know, it's really a helpful resource here.
I'd like to talk a little bit about, go back to the technology. It's come up a few different times. It's obviously not going to go away. It never goes away, because technology is always evolving, right? But how do you design for spaces that can adapt to rapidly evolving technology needs?
Yeah, I have two clients, two separate systems right now that we're working with in two separate regions of our state, Texas being where I'm at. And they're both experiencing the same sort of issues with what are we going to do? We know we want to move to more autonomous digital check-in registration platforms.
Right.
But they're not there yet. They're not sure. They're waiting. They're getting data and information from their consumer experience teams. Mm. And we have to be kind of sitting on the back end, rushing, right?
That's to meet. Trickle down, right? Yeah.
Yes. And then immediately meeting. Some of the things that we've done for both these clients is more temporary stations. So both of these clients are doing more tablet type check-in as they come in. One's a hospital, one's more of a clinic situation. And we're designing these spaces so that they have a place, a sense of place, like right at the front entry. They feel like there's a home proportionally in the space. But then if they need to go, they can go immediately. We'll fill it with some other amenity that's needed at that time. I think having all the infrastructure is critical.
Oh,
whether, because it may not be that they get rid of that tablet. It may mean they go to something more biometric or holographic, or it's a person standing there and they're leading and navigating them. You know, so there could be so many different things that happens between today and maybe 5 years they're moving to biometric, maybe 10 years this is gone and it's a whole other thing.
And it's all robots.
Right. And so we sit and we do our patient flows. We work with our clinicians on our team to look at those operational flows. And we just start looking at these pivotal moments, identifying them, working with the client, and we're making sure all that infrastructure is ready to go. And we're designing around it so it feels like a seamless environment today and tomorrow.
I would agree with just creating that infrastructure on the higher ed side. Just an example is where we've had wall-mounted monitors placed throughout a facility, and just not knowing what technology they might have there in the future, oversizing it. I think we think about our finishes too, and how we're applying that, and is that going to allow for them to change whatever is happening in front of the finish in the future? So we are purposeful with those locations. But it is a challenge because a lot of our projects, as we're designing it now, they're not going to be built for some time. So in the end, there may be changes that we'll have to make. But as best as we can set it up for success, I think that's what we try and do. And one thing I haven't had the opportunity to do on any of my projects, but could be an option for a client, is these demountable walls and being able to have these panels that are switched out if they change the needs of the space or change the technology. That could be an option for them.
That's fascinating too, both the things that you just said. But in a way related, I'm thinking of like our homes, right? And like when I was growing up, my parents built a home and they custom built into the wall a space for the TV. And of course, it was a big box and it was very deep. And this is like the mid-90s. And now I'm thinking of like my wife and I just built a home like 3-4 years ago, and it's there's a plug-in on the wall, and that way you don't have to control how big it is, and it sits so flat against it now. And I know that's been 30 years, but just the changes in that, not having a landline for a lot of places, and you just don't know where it's going. So it's like, well, we need spots for power, but like, let's not control the entire space. So it was just something that popped in my head while you're talking about that. Okay, I'd like to talk about materials for a few minutes. What materials are you both gravitating to as you work into your projects?
So a lot of our projects have standards, especially on the higher ed or on the healthcare side. The client has facility standards, or like I mentioned earlier, we're doing an addition or a renovation. So a lot of times it's using what they already have, what they're comfortable with. But when we do have the opportunity to introduce some new materials, new flooring, we do a lot of resilient flooring in both higher education and in healthcare. And when we can, we try and have sustainable options for that. I've done a lot of linoleum on our projects here, just because it's a product that's been around for a long time. You know, it's highly used in Europe. We've got clients here who have used it for a long time. They feel comfortable with it. And it's a PVC-free vinyl alternative. That's a product that we tend to use a lot.
Just from sort of more of a market trend or what the manufacturers are coming out. I'm just so impressed by the woods now, the faux woods that have come out. We used to only have cherry, maple, and oak to play with. And now we have films, we have the laminates, we have the wood look resilient floorings, we have linoleum that looks like wood, we have felt that looks like wood, and the textures and the tones. You open up these books and there's like 1 to 20 of lighter colors.
It's overwhelming.
Yes. Right. It's overwhelming, but it's finally a place where now we can layer our woods better. We've never been able to really layer woods because we've had to deal with what's this head wall come in and what does this furniture come in. And at your home, you don't see the same wood. You don't see four cherries that all look the exact same. So we've never really gotten that, especially in healthcare and education, where we have to have super durable. We can't use wood veneers. And so we have to use these faux woods. And it's really exciting to see them. They have softer textures. They have more matte looks. They're not shiny. I just have a feeling that's more calmer and serene. So I'm loving that. And then also we have to use a lot of solid surface in our projects because it's super durable. It's cleanable. We don't use a lot of natural stone or even quartz for that matter. And so now these solid surfaces are coming out and they look like real stone. The veining is incredible. And so these clients that are wanting that more hospitality look, we're able to give it to them. We can put it on a wall. We can use it on our custom millwork. We can put it in portals. We can use it as wall protection. I mean, we're really getting a lot more than we used to in the institutional world of healthcare and education. It's really come a long way.
Karen, you mentioned linoleum, and I know we were talking sustainable. Are there other sustainable materials that are gaining traction in these markets?
Yes, PVC-free, resilient, PVC-free LVT floors. And I say LVT in quotes because that stands for luxury vinyl tile. And these are vinyl-free alternates. So we are seeing really all of our manufacturers, most of our manufacturers coming up with PVC-free alternates for the products that we have. So I think hopefully in a few years, as these products have been down for a while and they seem to be working and have no issues, I think we'll start to use them a little bit more in our projects. But in healthcare and higher education, the products have to last. And so I've got a little bit of reservation personally about just in proposing a new product that's new on the market. I want it to be tested and make sure that it's going to work first. That's why I gravitate a little bit more towards linoleum than other products. But it's great to see that the manufacturers are all really coming up with better, healthier products.
I'm so excited about this PVC-free. And just like Karen, we all work together. So we're not going to be putting something in that we don't know about yet. But we're always asking our clients, do you want a free mock-up in a room? Is there a space? Because as soon as we just get that one or two clients that can provide the case study, I feel like the market will come, right? It's just, they've got so many case studies in Europe, but it's just the U.S. is just a little behind right now.
Right.
So we just need one or two progressive mind systems that are ready to go for it.
And, right.
But all the manufacturers would love to put free mock-up floors in a room so they can test them out and see them. So we're consistently asking that question because that would be the next step. And then we can move on from PVC.
Isn't that how it always works? It starts in Europe and then it goes to our coasts and then it moves in towards the center. Okay. What are some of the biggest challenges you guys are facing in today's market?
I think the biggest thing we're seeing today is just a challenge with unknowns related to tariffs and trying to specify products, use products that are USA made, which we always try and do anyway. But we've had a lot of projects that are just starting out construction and the contractors are wanting to get through all the submittals, order all the product now, just because we don't know how prices might change, what's going to happen to them down the road. And so just on our end, that can be a little bit challenging, just workload-wise, trying to get through all of that. But I think that's a challenge that we've just been working with lately. Luckily, we haven't had issues with lead times of anything that I've had issues with like we have in the past, but just working through that.
We've always tried to add made in the USA product. We ask those questions often, especially when we're trying to be sustainable and trying to stay within that 500 mile radius, or that's just the client's preference. And I think now more than ever, we're asking the question even more, maybe even, try to get a sticker on the side of the book. We always ask if it's in stock, but now it's like, Is it made in the USA? Is it in stock? How much is it on stock? So we know we can get it later. We've seen that resilient flooring, which is our main flooring type that we use in these facilities, it's not made here very much. There's a very limited amount being made in the U.S. and most of it's overseas. So maybe that market will start out. Maybe those factories can leverage at this point. But right now, that I think that's the challenge, is the resilient flooring.
Well, we talk a lot about how BSA and our mission statement is to create inspired solutions that improve lives. So I'm always remiss sometimes. I feel like if I don't ask this question on the podcast, let's talk about some of those creative solutions with the two of you. Can you share an example of a recent project where you had to get creative to solve a design challenge?
Sure. We are in one right now, of course, always, right?
Right.
So we are working on a clinic that serves a very large population, and that population includes refugees from multiple countries. And it's an adaptive reuse project. So the clinical layout is very complicated based on the existing footprint of the building. Their procedure or operational flows is that they take them back to exam, and then the patient leads themselves out of this complicated labyrinth of corridors and nurse stations. So without knowing the language and the culture.
Right.
And any other disabilities and what they have.
Right.
So we thought we came up with a pretty decent layered wayfinding approach. We knew it was going to be difficult. We had color. We had signage, literal signage with a couple of languages. We couldn't do everything, but a couple of languages. And then some murals. And this, we're going to go back to Zara and give her a plug again.
Yeah, absolutely.
our director of research. So we're sitting there, we're looking at all this, and we're like, let's walk it over and let's see what she thinks about this. And she said we had the basics, but we needed about four more layers on top. And this was interesting about when we come in, and I think you mentioned this a little bit earlier about education. We all went to school. We bring our knowledge and experience to the table. And I think that that's valid and it's valued. But then we also bring our cultural biases to the table, not knowingly. And I think we came up with some murals and some ideas of artwork that we thought would resonate and be a nice cue and strategy that we found out would mean nothing to some of these populations.
Yep.
Whether that was local iconography, we like to do that because it's fun, because it brands and has identity. These people don't know what that local iconography is. So basically our task was bring this down a level, put yourself in those shoes. Now we try to design for the cues to be some color, if you're colorblind, some sort of symbolism, and maybe some cues on the floor and the ceiling. And it was like, we need to simplify this and take this back to what we all know. And we see a lot of animals in healthcare, and sometimes I think, oh gosh, can we do another animal? But it really is like there is only a couple, like plant life, animals. There's only a couple things that we all can resonate with. Right. So I'm realizing why we're using those so much. So now here we are, and we've added lighting, another layer now too, and we're right now in the process of coming up with different, more symbolic and simplistic murals at these cues and these pivotal decision-making points. And then we'll probably sit back and go through them again. But we thought we nailed it. And she's like, no.
Time to go back through the innovation framework again.
Exactly. Right. It was really eye-opening. Honestly, I talk about it a lot because I think I've been doing this for 20 years and you never stop surprising yourself, and what the people around you and the clients we serve around us. So it's a great learning experience.
That was a really good example. Karen, how about you?
We've got a challenge we're actually working through right now as well.
I love immediate examples. It's not from 5 years ago. It's great.
There's always challenges that we're working through. But this particular project, we had meetings on this week. It's an addition and a renovation to a hospital in North Carolina, more of a rural hospital. And we are moving their women's center entrance to the main entrance of the hospital. Mm. And they're doing that so that it's more secure. They're going to be adding a weapons detection to the vestibule and even a bag scanner, because they've got a lot of women coming to the hospital that are in labor, and they've got all their bags, their stuff. They're going to be here for a few days. And that's currently just slowing them down. So in the future, they want to be able to add this bag scanner. But for now, we need to make sure that we're accommodating this weapons detection system, which is something that we're starting to see in a lot of our projects. So it's been a challenge to try and figure out how to add this system into their existing vestibule. You know, we're going to have to make it a little bit bigger, but it's been a team effort to work through that flow. I talked about that patient flow earlier and really think about, okay, you come through the front doors and had where to go, and what if there's queuing behind the weapons detection? What if you get stopped after because you need to be checked for something? Is there a table or a little corner that you can go off into, and other people can keep going through that? So we were able to work through the flow and look at the cut sheets of the product and come up with a solution that worked for them. In this scenario, it was form follows function. We had to make sure that this is going to function well for them. It's their first impression of the building too. And so we've supplemented that with bringing in branding elements, some stone into the vestibule, some wood tone. So trying to get them to come through to one side of it by adding some wood and some warmth and using that as a welcoming feature so that they know where to go within that space. And lighting, as Jen mentioned earlier too, we're really thinking through the lighting of it. And vestibules, sometimes I feel like you don't think about them. You think about the lobby and what happens after you go through the vestibule. But in this scenario, we're treating the vestibule a little bit higher end to offset that scariness that a weapons detection may have for someone walking through that space.
That's a good example too. Well, I always love to finish with a question that looks to the future in some way. So what trends do you see emerging that aren't mainstream yet?
As I mentioned earlier, we are hearing a lot more about designing for neurodiversity, and the research is starting to come out, but I think we're going to see a lot more in the future. We just had a lunch and learn here, and they were talking about the LRV, the light reflectance value of finishes. And again, in Europe, they're using this as a decision-making factor when they're looking at flooring. So making sure that between the floors and the walls that there's a light reflectance value difference of at least 30, so that there's contrast between the two. And this isn't just for neurodiverse individuals, but people with dementia, aging people who have a hard time seeing colors, just to give them that sense of comfort of where the floor is stopping and the wall is starting. And similarly with flooring transitions, there's a light reflectance index that it said should be I think 10 points higher between different, not more than 10 points higher between different floor types, so that it doesn't look like there's a hole or a step. And so that's just something that I haven't heard of too much. I see LRV values on the products we specify, but I've never paid too much attention to it. So it'll be interesting to see if that's something that we're going to be paying more attention to in the future as we're getting more research and information on designing for all people.
And as more comes out on that, I may have to have you come back on and talk some more about it. Jen, how about you?
I think Karen's right on with the inclusivity of bringing in that neurodiversity and hearing the buzzword of trauma-informed design and knowing that if it's a behavior health or if it's a standard healthcare facility, we need all these people are coming to one place. And how are we alleviating anxiety and safety feelings of nurture and just that heightened sense of I'm not in control? How do we pull that back in and give them some control back? And I'm not totally sure what that means yet, but I feel like that's going to be right there at the first part of our alignment, and we're going to be, and our clients are going to want us to talk about that more. I also wonder where technology, we talked a lot about the building and how it interacts with us and what that means. So is it just us interacting with this piece of technology at the front door, or is the building sensing us as we're coming in?
Ooh,
and
good.
What does that mean for interior design? And how do we also promote that interaction? I'm not sure. I know Karen and I were talking earlier, and after COVID, there was all this talk about sensors in the building and knowing your air quality. And we're not seeing that mainstream right now still. We're not seeing the building knowing when you walk into a room and the light dims because you're about to have a calm conversation. And it's not mainstream, but I feel like that response and interaction with the building is going to probably take hold. Or I'd love it too. I mean, that'd be really neat, right?
Yeah. Interesting. Oh, okay. We're going to have a follow-up conversation at some point because I like those things right there at the end. Well, this has been great. Thank you both for coming on the show. And I hope to have another conversation with you in the future.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Brian.
I'd like to thank Karen and Jen again for joining me on this episode of BSA by Design. You can connect with them each on LinkedIn. If you want to learn more about BSA, we encourage you to visit our website at BSA Design. There's a link in the show notes to contact us for more information. Be sure to subscribe to BSA by Design on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music so you don't miss an episode. And be sure to check out BSA on social media, including LinkedIn and YouTube. That's going to do it for this episode. Join us again next time on BSA by Design.